Live from West Babylon, New York, this is Sports Talk 1240.
Good evening and hello again, everybody. Welcome to hour number one of Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB Freeport, Long Island, New York. I'm Bill Donahue. I'll be taking you through the first hour on this Sunday night, the second day of April. Our engineer, Brian Graves, is with us, alive and well, and across the way tonight. We've got a great show for you tonight. Once again, it's book season. And up first, we'll welcome in author Mike Carey. We'll discuss his new book, Bad News, The Turbulent Life of Marvin Barnes, Pro Basketball's Original Renegade. In the second half, we'll welcome a returning guest to the show, author John Florio, who will join us and talk about his latest book, One Nation Under Baseball, How the 1960s Collided with the National Pastime. Coincidentally, the foreword for both of these books was written by Bob Costas. I think that's very interesting, and we'll use that as an underlying theme this evening. So sit back, relax, and enjoy Sports Talk 1240 tonight on GBB. We've got some great stuff ahead for you in the next few hours. As always, before we begin, I invite you to follow us on our Facebook page titled Sports Talk 1240. There you'll find sports information, show information, and more. So stop by, give us a look, then you can click and give us a like. You can also follow us on Twitter at SportsTalk1240. And all past shows can be heard on our website at www.SportsTalk1240.com. Well, my first guest worked 19 years at the Boston Herald, serving as news editor, then sports editor, and finally as Celtics beat writer during the Larry Bird era. In addition, he wrote the annual NBA draft preview for the Sporting News and was a regular contributor to Basketball Digest and Hoop Magazine. He's also the author of several books on basketball, including Boston Celtics, Where Have You Gone? But his new book we're going to talk about tonight is titled Bad News, The Turbulent Life of Marvin Barnes, Pro Basketball's Original Renegade. I welcome to the show tonight Mike Carey. Mike, good evening.
Good evening, Bill. How you doing?
Great. It's great to have you with us, Mike.
Well, thanks for having me.
No worries. Now, the foreword, as we said, by Bob Costas, who was the radio voice of the Spirits of St. Louis. I understand he doesn't do many of these things. How'd you get him to do the foreword for your book? You probably knew him from before.
No, I had never met him.
Okay.
I had talked to him on the phone, and he was very cooperative in, you know, being interviewed. And when I was through with the main text of the book, I sent him a manuscript and just asked him to look it over. And I knew that he had told people that he did not want to do any more blurbs or forewords or prefaces for books. He just didn't have the time, so I didn't even ask him. When he finished reading the manuscript, he called me up and he said, "Well, who's doing the foreword?" And I said, "Well, no one. I was just going to do a preface myself, and that would be it." And he said, "Well, could I write it?" And I said, "Sure."
Outstanding.
I was shocked that, you know, a guy with his schedule, and it's pretty hectic, would do it. And he did a great job, and he's been a great friend to me.
He sure certainly did do a good job, Mike. Now, the cover of the book, I have to ask you, I was looking at it this afternoon. I bet you that's Billy Paul's garden, Marvin Barnes, on the cover of that book. Do you
think
so? Yeah. And Billy was our guest a couple of weeks ago, a very good man. He's living down in San Antonio, and just a tremendous guest, talking about the Nets and the ABA, which I really enjoy. All kids, I believe, in my era used to love the ABA with the three-point line. The whole red, white, and blue ball, the run-and-gun style of play. Of course, the Miami Floridians ball girls, what's not to like. And just a wonderful job by Billy Paltz. We'll talk a little bit about Marvin at Providence College. Where he was a friar at Providence. Well, let's talk a little bit about his college career, Mike.
He had a tremendous college career. He was... He led the nation in rebounding as a senior. averaged 22 points and 18.7 rebounds a game. He had been drafted twice by the ABA. First time was called a free agent draft, and the second time was called a junior draft. And he turned them both down. And then when the NBA draft rolled around, Bill Walton was taken first and Marvin Barnes was taken second. And everybody figured that Marvin would go to the NBA because it was the more prestigious of the two leagues. But the Spirits of St. Louis was a new team, and his agent was Bob Wolf, who at the time was considered one of the best agents in the country.
Right.
And Wolf steered him to the Spirits, and he signed a contract for $2.2 million for a seven-year deal. And that sounds like pretty good money. But the problem is the money was spread over 14 years, which meant he was only making $150,000 a year, and that was before taxes. And Marvin had never handled that kind of money, and it got him in trouble. I mean, he was broke before his first game, and you know, it just wasn't. I mean, he had his moments in the ABA. There's no question about it, but. He probably would have been better off going to a more structured league. As he was Rookie of the Year,
right.
In the ABA, and when the playoffs rolled around, St. Louis just barely snuck into the playoffs. And their first-round opponent were the Nets. And the Nets had beaten the Spirits all 11 times they had faced them in the regular season. And they were the defending champions. And so nobody gave St. Louis a sniff of beating the Nets. And Marvin just had one of the greatest series of any player I know. He was matched up a lot of the times with Julius Erving. St. Louis won the series 4-1. Marvin outshot him 50-45%, out rebounded him 78-49.
Oh boy!
Outscored him 153-137, and. He had eight blocks to Julius's two. And Julius, when he retired, made a statement that he played in 13 losing playoff series his entire career. And he said that one was the most disappointing of them all.
Yeah.
So, you know, Marvin had a great first year. And, he was an all-star his second year, but during the second year, he met up with some gangsters, marijuana smugglers, and they basically hired Marvin to be their public relations guy. They'd fly in all their major buyers from across the country, and Marvin would get them front row seats for the Spirits games and host parties. And of course, at these parties, there'd be piles of cocaine and marijuana available and liquor available for all these buyers. And by the end of his second year, Marvin had an addiction problem.
Yeah.
And it would be a sign of the future, because he, for the rest of his life, he struggled with addiction.
And that more or less set him on the road. We got Mike Carey with us tonight on Sports Talk 1240. I'm glad you mentioned the draft, Mike, because he was drafted by the 76ers, as you say, with the second overall pick. Bill Walton goes first. Marvin Barnes goes second to the 76ers. But I'm glad you mentioned why Bob Wolfe happened to steer him to the Spirits of St. Louis. Not too many people know that. Let's take a look at how he got the nickname Bad News. I mean, it's not really hard to see, but I always thought that it came from, the original Bad News was Jim Bad News Barnes with the Boston Celtics, correct?
That is correct.
Yeah.
Jim Bad News Barnes played in the 60s, and Marvin was in high school, and he only played 2 years in high school. He didn't try out his sophomore year for the varsity. He played in a church league instead. And in the 2 years that he played, his team went 48-0. I mean, they never lost a game.
Yeah, that's amazing.
But Marvin wasn't a great shooter. And wanted to carve a niche for himself. So he decided he was going to be the team goon. And in his first five games, he was kicked out of four of them for picking fights with the opposition. And a teammate of his nicknamed him Bad News after Jim News Barnes. Jim Bad News Barnes, and the nickname just stuck, and that's how he got the nickname. The teammates started calling him Bad News because he was getting in all these fights, and finally the coach pulled him aside and said, "Look, Marvin, you know, you gotta cut out all this macho garbage
right.
And start playing basketball." And he did, and he never got thrown out of another game, and went from really being the 11th man on the team to being a starter within 2 months. And senior year, he was All-State, and ended up choosing Providence College.
He did. Now, certain incidents that I read about while I was doing my homework, Mike, Marvin and some of his cohorts decided to rob a bus when they were in high school.
Well, that's Marvin had a little gang of not what we would consider a gang today. You know, not these were just a bunch of kids that were they couldn't get a job in Providence because Providence was. City Hall was controlled, was all white. I mean, if you didn't know somebody at City Hall, it was pretty hard to get a city job.
Yeah.
And the private jobs were basically doled out by members of the patriarch or mob family.
Mm-hmm.
So it was hard. Like Marvin said, I handed in a million applications, and they were all rejected, and so I finally gave up and decided I would find a better way of making money. And so he and some of his friends decided they'd form this gang, and what they did is they would wait at a bus stop, hop on the bus, and steal the driver's fares. And, of course, the police had no trouble identifying Marvin because he was 6'7".
Right.
And
he had his name on his jacket, right?
Well, he claims that he had the jacket inside out before he robbed the buses. And but as one police officer told me, he said he probably did, but the guys at the station had a good long laugh when Marvin walked in handcuffed and wearing a jacket that says Big Marv and State Champs on it.
So, yeah.
That was he had a little bit of trouble, but you know, he also had a kindly judge who just put him on unsupervised probation, so he didn't get into any real deep serious problems with it.
Right.
And then you know he had a great career at Providence College. He was playing with Ernie DiGregorio.
He's
playing with Kevin Steakum, two guys that ended up having successful pro careers, and Marvin was the ideal teammate. Everybody liked the guy. In doing this book, I talked to almost all of his coaches and a number of players, probably close to 50. Of his teammates, and not one had a bad word to say about him.
That's tremendous, Mike. Yeah, I know. I had seen in the book the amount and the names that we'll get to in a little bit that you spoke to about Marvin. Well, we talked a little bit about the Spirits. They had a great ball club, definitely, and they had a guy named Maurice Lucas who was a bit of a character, too.
Well, Maurice ended up, you know, having... when he went to the NBA, he became the probably the best enforcer type player in the league.
Right.
But when he first came to the Spirits from Marquette University, he really wasn't. I don't think he knew that was a good way to further his career. So. Marvin and would elbow him and try to toughen him up, and it all ended one day when they were playing. I want to say they were playing Kentucky, and Artis Gilmore was on Kentucky's team, and Gilmore got mad at Maurice and took two steps towards him. And Maurice just decked him flat, and
that was
the end of Maurice's being timid about his role on the team. And from then on, he was the word was out: don't mess with Maurice Lucas.
Right.
and the Spirits were unique in that they had an all rookie front court. They had Marvin, they had Gus Gerard. And they had Maurice Lucas, and that was their starting front court.
Yeah, Gus Gerard, another great ABA name. Definitely.
Now, another ABA name and another guy who went down the same path as Marvin did for about 20 years, but he turned his life around.
He did, definitely. Yeah, Gus Gerard, folks. People may not realize till they read the book, which is, again, titled Bad News, The Turbulent Life of Marvin Barnes, Pro Basketball's Original Renegade by Mike Carey, that you opened your home to Marvin, and he lived with you for a period of time.
He did. Marvin spent time homeless out in East San Diego for 2 years. He lived in a burnt-out house that had no roof, and he spent time in prison for distribution of cocaine. He spent, I think it was 3 years and 3 months. When he did try to get sober, and he would check himself into rehab, and as I say in the very first chapter, he went to rehab 22 times to try to become clean and sober on a permanent basis, and 22 times he failed to achieve his goal. But when Marvin came back to Providence. He was afraid that he was going to bump into a drug dealer, and he had been sober for about 2 years. And so he called me up, and he asked me if he could stay at my house. And I said, you can stay here as long as, you know, we have the rules down. And the rules are, you know, no drinking, no drugs. And Marvin agreed to that. And Marvin was running a mentoring program for inner-city kids in Providence. And for 3.5 years, he did, and I would occasionally go down. It was sort of a scared straight type program.
Okay.
And I would occasionally go down and listen to either Marvin or a guest speaker talk to these kids. And he was really doing tremendous work with the kids. And he'd finish his mentoring class, and he'd come right back to my house. And for 3 years, I never had a problem with him. He was, you know, he was going to AA meetings, he was going to NA meetings, and I honestly thought that his life had turned a corner, and that, you know, he finally had been able to kick his addiction. And then one day he slipped, and I didn't notice it right away, but over the course of a month I started seeing signs that he'd leave the house at like 8 at night and wouldn't return till 6 in the morning. And there came a day where I was coming home from work, and Marvin's car was halfway in the driveway and halfway in, on the lawn.
Oh boy!
And the stereo was blaring, and the engine was running, and Marvin was passed out behind the wheel. And it took me a good 5 minutes to rouse him, and I asked him, I said, Marvin, what drugs are you taking? And he refused to answer me. And I had an argument with him, and I said, Marvin, this just has to stop. I mean, you knew the conditions for staying at my house, you know, I know you're using drugs. I mean, you're not going to fool me by saying no, I'm not. And anyhow, he said he wasn't. So I let it go by once. But about 3 days later, I came home from work, and I walked into my living room, and there was Marvin with one of his dealers. Smoking crack in my living room. And I said, Marvin, I said, you have two choices. You could either check yourself into rehab, or, you know, find another place to stay.
Right.
And he did check himself into rehab, and he completed the program. But when he completed the program, instead of coming back here, which I told him he should do, he went down to Providence to stay with his mother. And that was a big mistake, because his mother's in her 80s, and she couldn't monitor what he was doing.
No, right.
And Marvin had a court case coming up, and I hadn't talked to him for about 3 months, and he called me up. It was a Thursday. And he said, Mike, my court case is coming up on Monday. Can you come down? I need you in my corner. And I said, yeah, I'll come down, Marvin. But I could hear in his voice that it was a jittery voice. He was sort of slurring his words. And I knew he was using drugs. And I mean, here he has this important court case in 4 days, And I told him, I said, look, Marvin, do yourself a favor. You know, lay off the drugs for at least 4 days. I mean, the last thing you want is to walk into the court and, you know, being high.
Of course, yeah.
And he said, you're right, Mike. And Marvin could always say, you know, the right thing. So you're right, Mike. I'll be sober by the time I walk into court. So I drove down to Providence and went to the courtroom where the case was scheduled, and no Marvin. And I walked outside and I checked with the clerk of courts, and he was scheduled to be, his case was on the docket. So I walked outside the court and I called his cell phone, and the it went straight to voicemail.
Mm.
And I said, well, I'm going back to Boston. He obviously is not going to make this court appearance. And I didn't even get outside the city limits of Providence, and I got a call from his ex-wife telling me that they found him dead in bed at some acquaintance's house. And, you know, I didn't even ask what happened. I already knew that it,
sure.
You know, in my own mind, I knew it had to be a drug overdose. And 3 months later, when the coroner issued his report, it was that he died of acute heroin and cocaine intoxication. And it was just sad because he had done, he was, you know, he had, for 3 years, he had done everything the right way. I had talked to these kids that he had mentored, and they all, to this day, they all have done very well in, they not only graduated high school, but they went on to college, He had a remarkable effect on their lives, and Marvin was that way with kids. He had a terrible childhood. His father was an abuser, abused the whole family, physically abused them, and he was a chronic alcoholic. And I think Marvin always had a soft spot for kids as an adult. He would sneak 10 kids into a game at Providence College, and later at whatever team he was with, he
right.
would do the same thing. And then he'd give each kid enough money to buy either a basketball or a pair of Chuck Taylors. And this was the one constant thing about Marvin, is he always tried to, you know, be a positive influence for kids.
Yeah.
And I actually went to some of his talks, and he would always begin the talks by saying, I was a dope. I could have had millions of dollars, but I thought doing marijuana and cocaine was cool, and by the time I realized, by the time I found out that it wasn't cool, it was too late.
It was too late, right, yeah.
You know, he told a story, Bill, and I put this in the book, too. He was clean and sober, and he was staying at my house, and he got a call from a guy who he was friendly with in Providence. And the guy had a son who was about 16 years old, and the son had been shot in the head.
Oh, boy.
And the guy wanted Marvin to come down to Providence and visit his son. And Marvin said, sure, I'll come down there. So he went down, and, you know, the kid was in a coma and probably didn't know Marvin was there. But as Marvin is at the kid's bedside, he notices that on the kid's right arm is a tattoo that says Thug Life. And Marvin, at his next speech to the kids, said, you know, relayed that story and said, Thug Life is a game that is designed for you to lose. There's nothing cool about being a thug. And he said that same kid had $700 in his right pants pocket, and he probably got that $700 by selling drugs. And he said now he's in a hospital bed with a bullet in his brain. What good is that $700 going to do him?
None at all.
And the kids, you know, there was silence in the auditorium. I mean, Marvin could get his message to these kids so well and so eloquently. And Marvin was a street guy. I mean, the unique thing about Marvin, I mean, he had a college degree, and he could talk like a college professor. But on the other hand, if he was talking to kids, he knew all the street jargon.
Yeah.
And he had a way of reaching people. And
it's a shame. You know, a real waste, Mike.
It was a turbulent life, definitely. It was tragic. It really was.
Well, and, Mike, I'll tell you, it's been a pleasure speaking with you tonight, Mike. Mike's a graduate of Chaminade out here in Mineola. We won't hold that against him, though. And I thank you for spending part of your Sunday night with us, Mike. Once again, the book is titled Bad News, The Turbulent Life of Marvin Barnes, Pro Basketball's Original Renegade. Once again, thank you, Mike Carey.
Thank you, Bill.
Have a good night. Mike Carey, folks. Up next, we'll talk to author John Florey about his new book, One Nation Under Baseball, How the 1960s Collided with the National Pastime. Stick around, folks.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240 on Long Island's AM 1240. WGBB.
Country Foot Care, official podiatrists of the New York Lizards, have been delivering state-of-the-art foot care with good old-fashioned caring to Long Island residents for over 30 years. Specialists in sports medicine and foot injuries, Country Foot Care can be reached at 516-741-FEET or online at countryfootcare.com.
Want to advertise your business on Sports Talk 1240? Place an ad on sportstalk1240.com and run a radio commercial during the show every Sunday night here on AM 1240 WGBB. Our rates are very affordable. We'll even produce the radio commercial for you. Just head over to sportstalk1240.com and fill out the Contact Us form and let us start promoting your business today.
Unflippable, unflappable, unleakable. The Gustbuster is the only umbrella that won't flip inside out, rip, tear, or leak. Capable of withstanding winds over 55 miles per hour. All of our umbrellas are constructed of the finest quality materials and backed by a limited lifetime guarantee. What are you waiting for? Visit Gustbuster.com and get your Gustbuster today.
Stay connected to Sports Talk 1240 by following us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Sports Talk 1240.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240, broadcasting every Sunday night beginning at 8 p.m. right here on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB, the station that serves your community. And now, back to the show.
All right, we're back with Sports Talk 1240 on GBB Freeport, New York. Bill Donahue with you. I hope you're enjoying the program tonight. We had the Yankees losing in Tropicana Field in St. Petersburg tonight against the Rays. Mets, of course, open tomorrow afternoon versus the Braves at Citi Field with Syndergaard on the hill. Baseball is back, ladies and gentlemen. Well, my next guest is a freelance writer and novelist. Last time we spoke on the program, we discussed his great work, One Punch from the Promised Land, Leon Spinks, Michael Spinks, and the Myth of the Heavyweight Title. a great book that was. Now, tonight we'll talk about his latest effort entitled One Nation Under Baseball, How the 1960s Collided with the National Pastime. I welcome to Sports Talk 1240 tonight, John Florio. John, good evening.
Good evening, Bill. It's nice to be back.
Great to have you with us, John. Now, this book does a great job of describing the 60s quite vividly for those who probably were born later. It does a great job. Some of it doesn't address baseball as the only sport. We have boxing, football, the Olympics are involved during the collisions during the 60s radical time period. Imagine, John, if social media was around in the 60s like it is today.
Oh, you're just talking about a totally different history, right? I mean, everything changes. Yeah. Or imagine it weren't around today. Today changes, right?
Exactly. What a life we'd be going through then. Now, you open up with a story of the great Jim Mudcat Grant, who had a phone call from then-Senator John Kennedy. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Well, you know, we thought that was the best way to start the book, because the book's really, like you said, there's a lot of different stories going on.
Right.
And when I was sitting down with Weezy Shapiro, the co-author of the book, and my wife, we were sitting and talking about how we're going to address the different stories that are going on. And sometimes baseball was influenced by other things. They didn't really happen exactly together. For example, you know, later in the book, Jim Boughton writes Ball 4. Well, Jim Boughton's publishing of Ball 4 kind of came about as a wave of change in publishing. So we covered those stories as well as the outcome with Jim Boughton. But when we said, where are we going to start the book? Here in 1960, we have Mudcat Grant meeting with John F. Kennedy, sitting down, having breakfast together. It felt like the perfect launch point for the book, because you have both characters on stage at the same time. You know, you have Mudcat Grant and John Kennedy, and they're talking about issues, social issues. You know, a lot of the book is about what went on in baseball, but it's how baseball affected society, and vice versa, how the social issues affected baseball. So here we have a scene. We have Mudcat Grant sitting down with John F. Kennedy. Kennedy actually went to him, wanted to sit down with him and talk about issues that were going on in Florida, Lacoochee, Florida, which is where Mudcat Grant was
from. That's where he hails from, right?
Yeah, and he wanted to get a sense of you know, what he was going through, what the black community was going through at the time. And the two of them are sitting down, and Mudcat Grant tells stories, which are in the book. I mean, just, you know, very tough stories about growing up in the Jim Crow South in Florida when the Jim Crow laws were still around. And then we use that to go into the story starts to break off from there. We see Jackie Robinson at the time,
right,
who's actually a Nixon supporter.
Imagine that, yeah.
Yeah. Right? That was... I have to say, I think, you know, a lot of people were surprised about that. They
Definitely,
said to me, wow,
yeah,
Jackie Robinson was a Nixon supporter.
Yeah.
But it wasn't because he wasn't for civil rights. He felt Nixon was the guy over Kennedy who understood the plight of the black community more. But interesting that we have the conversation with Mudcat Grant and Kennedy, where we realize Kennedy's really making an effort to learn, to reach out, to understand. And then we see Jackie Robinson with supporting Nixon, and then we also see spring training going on down in Florida in the Jim Crow South, where, you know, players from the north, the black players, guys like Bill White, who were in integrated areas, basically. I mean, you know, there was all sorts of bias and segregation going on anyway, but in the north it was a much different scene. He goes down to Florida to play in spring training, and all of a sudden the team is segregated. So
Right. That
was kind of... We felt that was a great launch point, because it sent us off. It sent different story threads off in different directions.
Sure, definitely did. Yeah, great way to start the book, John. John Florio with us tonight. We then run into a period with Sandy Koufax holding out with Don Drysdale, and that's interspersed with the Watts riots in 1965.
Right. Right. Well, you know, what's interesting about the Koufax story is, well, first of all, the holdout. We treated that as part of, there were really three arcs, you know, in storytelling. We talk of the different arcs, you know, your story starts and it swells, then it resolves at the end. So we have three main ones going. We have the issue of race, which you and I just touched on a little bit with the Mudcat Grant story. We also have publishing, which I mentioned briefly, which is the, you know, we see Dick Young and the sports writers of the time, and then new journalism comes and it kind of resolves with Jim Bouton. But the other arc, Sandy Koufax and Don Drysdale were very important to, was the labor unions and the labor strikes that were going on in the 60s, a little reflective of what was going on in society as well. But in baseball, Koufax and Drysdale decided they were going to hold out together. I mean, this just wasn't done back then. Two people, you know, saying the two of us are going to hold out. Mm-hmm. Now, the reason that was so unheard of is, first of all, because the owners would never tell other people what the other guy was making. So they'd play each other off each other. Like they'd say to Koufax, you want $100,000? Are you crazy? Even Don Drysdale only makes $70,000. And then they'd say the same thing to Drysdale, and nobody knew what each other were doing. So Koufax and Drysdale sit down. They decide we're going to hold out together. And what that was and why it worked for our arc of labor unions is really it's the first union negotiation. I mean, it's two people coming. It's a very small union. It's a union of two members.
Right.
But it's the first time players are coming together to start negotiating together. And then, of course, that, you know, takes us down the road of Marvin Miller and the you know, the start of the Players Association as we know it today. It had been around for years, but it was more of an owner-run, more of a company union as opposed to a players' union. And then, you know, that leads us down a whole different road. But the other thing about Koufax, which I found really interesting, we talk about it in the book, you know, a lot of people know he held out during the – I'm sorry, hold out is not the right expression. But he didn't want to play on Yom Kippur.
Right.
And he said, I want to sit during Yom Kippur. And that was big news at the time. A guy's not pitching in the World Series. I mean, he ended up more than carrying his weight by coming back and pitching twice. But at the time, he said, I'm not going to pitch on Yom Kippur. And to this day, rabbis are telling us when kids who are getting bar mitzvahs and bat mitzvahs, girls getting bat mitzvahs, saying the most important religious character, the most important role model they have in their religion, to this day, of the top three names, it's like Sandy Koufax.
Imagine. Yeah, that's great.
And Koufax didn't know. Koufax wasn't really making a big religious statement. I don't even think he was a super religious guy. I think he just said, I'm not going to pitch on the... He didn't realize how big it was going to become, and now it's, you know, all these years later.
He's an activist, yeah.
Right.
Definitely. And speaking of Marvin Miller and baseball with the reserve clause, we then have Curt Flood with his attempt to challenge that clause and really set a precedent for players from then on.
Well, yeah. Well, Flood's case... has been looked at every different way possible. But I think that one of the interesting things that we have in the book is you see a lot of other, when you zoom out and you look at Curt Flood and how it's happening that he's going to the Supreme Court, the same time really Muhammad Ali is going to the Supreme Court on his case, you see like the whole society's kind of acting together. You look at it and you say, well, you know, if it wasn't Curt Flood, and listen, he really stood up and he took the heat, so I'm not taking anything away from Curt Flood. But if it weren't him, the timing was right that somebody was going to do that when you look at how the whole decade was shaping up at that point. And I think one of the interesting things in the book is some of the court transcripts when the judges, you know, they show him his baseball card. And they asked him how well he played like the previous year. So I don't remember the exact dialogue, but he couldn't remember. So they showed him his own baseball card. So the idea of like a childhood idol, you know, I was just a kid at that time. But Curt Flood sitting there reading off his own baseball card in the court is just a great scene.
Oh yeah, definitely. And then we talk about John, one of the great events of the '60s, the summer of '69, with the New York Mets. Their fans and the moon landing taking place at the same time. Very surreal.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I grew up in Queens right by Shea Stadium.
Right, that's right, yeah.
You remember, we spoke about it last time, yeah. And, you know, it's funny because I wasn't a Mets fan. I was a Yankee fan.
Mm-hmm.
And everything was the Mets. I mean, you know, I was like, what's going on? Like, everybody's talking about the Mets. I was too young to really appreciate what had happened here. I mean, this team was god-awful, and I mean, you know, legendary, the amazing Mets, right? How they turned it around. But, you know, the other things that were going on during that turnaround in 69 where you have, first of all, the Vietnam protesters outside the stadium, you know, and using Tom Seaver's face, and Seaver saying, you know, I had nothing to do with this. I'm not aligned with that group, but I'll make my statement afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
And he, too, he took out an ad in the New York Times, which we talk about, and he said, you know, I think he said on New Year's Eve, let's have a prayer for peace or something. I don't have the wording in front of me, but something along those lines. He and his wife, Nancy Seaver, took out an ad about Vietnam. So you have, like, Vietnam and baseball coming together there. And, of course, you also have the story of John Lindsay running for mayor after his popularity was so low at the time. And he actually ended up getting back in New York's good graces because of a photo that happened to be shot randomly during the celebration. He's getting doused with champagne.
Right.
I think it was Grody and Gaspar, like pouring that wave.
Another aspect in the book, John, that you bring out that I was unaware of was the whole movement of the Dodgers to the West Coast. They build Dodger Stadium in Chavez Ravine, and they were displacing Mexican immigrants while they were doing it.
Yeah, that's kind of like a part of the history that nobody really talks about.
I mean,
they talk about O'Malley going out there, and but there was a lot of, they displaced them, and there were like promises made of what was going to happen, and none of that ever really got resolved. You know, O'Malley moved out there. We went to the Brooklyn Historical Society. I don't know if any of your listeners are really like into the old Brooklyn Dodger and Ebbets Field and the whole leaving of Brooklyn for L.A.
Mm-hmm.
All of those letters are in the Historical Society. The originals are
wow.
in, like, you know, wrapped in acetate.
Yeah.
And we're looking at this, and really what's interesting is that O'Malley, it seems, looking at those letters, didn't want to go, or at least he made a case that he didn't want to go. What he was looking for was he wanted to have a stadium in Brooklyn where Atlantic meets Flatbush. And at the time, Robert Moses, the head of the Parks Commission, said to him, no, you can't. We can't do that. He really wanted him to play in Flushing Meadow Park,
mm-hmm.
which ended up becoming where the Mets moved. But O'Malley didn't want it. He looked at it. He said, that place is a dumping ground. I don't want to put a stadium. You can't put a stadium there. Nobody's going to go there. But I will stay in Brooklyn if I could get this piece of land, this piece of property. And Moses said, well, we can't do it. You can't possibly put a stadium there. And the irony, you know, there's been a few ironies in our call tonight, but that the irony on this particular irony is that it's where Barclays Stadium is now. It's where the Barclays Center is. That would have been where the Dodgers were playing.
Right, and people blame Walter O'Malley, who just recently was elected to the Baseball Hall of Fame, when the villain in the whole thing is the great, great Robert Moses. I say that firmly tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, Robert Moses had his hands in a lot of stuff. It's funny, I think Robert Caro wrote a book called The Power Broker about Moses, and it's a phenomenal work. It's really in depth. I mean, it's the definitive work on him, and the influence and the legacy he left is unbelievable in New York. I mean, for better or worse, but I mean his fingerprints are all over. I mean, the BQE, the extension of the LIE, a lot of the roads and highways are his, and a lot of the infrastructure, you know, is his. We talk about him with the World's Fair.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was the infrastructure was still there from the previous World's Fair in Flushing Meadow Park. He said, "No, I want to rebuild the whole thing. I want to redo another World's Fair. We're going to build it from the ground up." And I think there's an interesting scene in the book when the World's Fair opens. You have CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality, are there to protest, and they're threatening Stallings to stop the World's Fair. But meanwhile, the Mets are opening day is a couple of days later at Chase Stadium. So this is all happening at the same time. That's why the book is kind of, I think, all of these interrelated stories. We don't really have one main character. You know, you and I spoke about the Spinks book. We followed Leon and Michael Spinks. We had two very definite people we were following. Here we return to a lot of the same characters. But I guess, you know, the hero of our story here is a time period. So we have all of these different stories going on, and we're kind of putting them together like a puzzle to see how the decade shaped up with baseball as our focus, as opposed to Woodstock or, you know, whatever it happens to be, or the assassination or politics or the typical things we look at in the 60s. We looked at it through the lens of baseball, And, you know, you look at what would be an ordinary game, you know, you zoom out that lens and you start seeing all of these other things that are going on at the same time.
Definitely. Now, we spoke with my previous guest, Mike Carey, whose book about Marvin Barnes also has a foreword written by Bob Costas. And this book
night,
as well.
Know,
it's kind of an underlying theme. But Mike was also saying, John, that Bob didn't really want to get involved in any more of these type of projects, but you guys were able to get him to do it.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I was actually surprised that there was somebody else, not on this show, but that he had done another. Because when we spoke to him about this one, he said, you know, I'm really not doing this a lot. He's a busy guy, and he said, you know, I'm doing. He has certain projects that he's working on. He said, I'm focusing on these, but he. You know, we're friendly with Bob, and we've done some projects together. You know, Wheezy has worked with him a real lot through the years. I mean,
oh, okay.
I say we, but it's really Wheezy. And he was nice enough to read and endorse our book on Sphinx. But here we said, you know, you're the man when it comes to politics and baseball. And if you would take a look at this manuscript, you know, we'd see. And he read it and said, you know, I like it. I like it a real lot. I will do it because I like the job you guys did. So we really appreciated it because, you know, when it comes to baseball and politics and society and looking at baseball as a social force, you know, he's really the in my mind, like the main guy. So
sure is.
We were very, very happy that he wanted to get involved.
Yeah, a great tribute to Wheezy and yourself, definitely. Other things mentioned in the book, as the title suggests, colliding with the national pastime, the social aspects of the 1960s. We have Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy assassinations, mm-hmm. Martin Luther King supporting the striking workers in Memphis. We have the Democratic National Convention in Chicago, which was a big deal. And also Sonny Liston, Muhammad Ali, the list goes on. It's just a tremendous read.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. You know, what we did was, our main thing was we wanted the book to cover all of those things that you mentioned because we felt they were all important, but we also wanted it to be an interesting, fun book to read. We didn't want to do, and it could be done, and it would probably be a really worthwhile project, but what we didn't want to do was make a very thick academic tome out of it. You know, we really wanted to make it an interesting read where people could go through the 60s and see some of these stories. I mean, some of them are just fun,
yeah.
You know, and some of them are very heavy. You know, you mentioned the MLK assassination, which, of course, is, you know, that's one of the heaviest parts of the book, and you have Bob Gibson really reacting to it and delivering the 1968 season very largely because of his anger over the MLK assassination. But then there were the classic, you know, the Beatles and Muhammad Ali taking the photos together.
Yeah.
Those scenes are just great, you know.
you mentioned Gibson, John. There's also the contrast you make between Gibson and another great pitcher of the time, Denny McLain. They've taken different roads down through history, but there's another example right there.
Oh, my gosh. Two complete opposite guys.
Exactly.
Right? Their approach to the game, their approach to the whole, you know, Gibson, a very, very quiet guy to himself. McLain loving the spotlight.
You know,
going out, not really, you know, for lack of a better term, the one that comes to me right now is like a good time Charlie. You know, the guy just was a party wherever he went. He was fun. He was a quote machine. He, you know, the press loved him because he was always an interesting story. He's drinking 24 cans of Pepsi a day. You know, I mean, just that an athlete could do that and deliver the performance he gave is just unbelievable. He's flying out after the All-Star game out to Vegas. Being at Vegas, coming back, pitching a game, and winning 31 games that season. I mean, it's unbelievable. Meanwhile, Gibson is just digging in, and you have these two forces, a guy who's pitching like Gibson, he's angry at what's going on with the country. He's on top of his game. We spoke with Tim McCarver. We said, Tim, what was it that made him so good that year? And, you know, he spoke about the anger, and he spoke about the focus, but he said, the thing that just made him so effective is that his control was pinpoint control for the entire season. Wherever he threw the ball, wherever I put up my mitt, he hit it. I didn't have to move my glove the entire season.
Oh.
He said, "He goes." So you have Gibson on that track, and you have McLean on his, and the two of these forces are going to meet, you know, in the World Series.
For sure, yeah. Well, John Florio is with us tonight. The book is titled One Nation Under Baseball, How the 1960s Collided with the National Pastime. Again, the foreword by Bob Costas. John, it's been a pleasure having you with us tonight. Thanks for taking time out to be with us.
Absolutely, Bill. Thanks again for having me.
We'll talk to you soon. Take
care.
I'm
looking forward to it. Okay. Bye-bye.
John Florio, folks. So that'll do it for me tonight on Sports Talk 1240. I'd like to thank my guests, Mike Carey and John Florio, my engineer, Brian Graves, and most of all, you folks for joining us. Stay tuned for hour number two on Sports Talk 1240. I'll be back with you on Sunday, April 16th, with author Paul Dixon and his book, Leo DeRocher, Baseball's Prodigal Son. Till then, Bill Donahue, wishing you a good evening, folks.
Views expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.